From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. E.O. Wilson went into the wilderness exploring Gorongosa National Park. It's in the African nation of Mozambique. The famed biologist came back with a message for us all. Though we are slowly destroying our planet, it is not too late to save it and ourselves. This hour on Point, finding our proper place on Earth with a little help from our friends in the animal kingdom. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you think we have it in us to strike a balance, a bargain with nature? Should we preserve more of the natural environment, even if it means changing our lifestyles? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is E.O. Wilson, biologist, naturalist, and two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He is the world's leading expert on ants, the father of the field of sociobiology, professor emeritus at Harvard University, and he's out with a new book called A Window on Eternity, A Biologist's Walk Through Gorongosa National Park. You can find an excerpt on our website at onpointradio.org. It is beautiful and it's worth a read. Professor Wilson, thank you so much for being here and welcome back to On Point.
I thank you, Jessica. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Your book is stunningly beautiful. It's filled with essays about Gorongosa. Not only have you written this book, you've made repeated trips there and launched a foundation to preserve the park. What's so important about this place?
Let me take the opportunity, since you put it that way, and I hoped you would, to give full credit to Peter Naskreki, who is not only a great naturalist, but is an expert on the insect fauna, especially the area, and is one of the, in my opinion, world's finest natural history photographers. It certainly adds a lot to the book. Now you can ask me that question again.
The photographs are stunning. So is your language and your description of your experiences there. I'm curious, there must be many places around the globe that are worth preservation and your attention. Why are you focusing on this spot?
I had a grand opportunity, well, several grand opportunities in going to Gorongosa. First was, I'd never been to sub-Sahara Africa before. I'd been everywhere else, I mean, in every other continent, and worked in rainforests and other habitat, but never had gone south of the Sahara. I was just expecting that that would be permanent, but suddenly the opportunity was presented to me, and that brings me to the second reason why I went to Gorongosa. The park is being rehabilitated by a mastermind, American philanthropist, and I like to call him world citizen, Greg Carr. And he has fallen in love with the park himself. He was particularly struck by its near destruction. That is, it certainly had the big game destroyed during the terrible Mozambique Civil War that ran from 1978 to 1992, and he chose to devote his life to restoring the park to its original condition as close as possible. He invited me in as a consultant, and we've become close friends, and I've had the pleasure of working now on three trips to the park. It was a great opportunity further to see how a park can be restored, even when it's partly damaged, and to gain a better understanding of why we must have these kind of parks all around the world. The bigger they are, the better, and the more of them there are, the more likely we are to save the world as we know it.
Would you describe the landscape and the natural beauty? Take us there, if you would. What does it look like?
It's one of the most remarkably topographically diverse parks in Africa, and it's also one of the most biologically diverse. We have, over most of the park, which covers the tail end, the southern extremity of the Great African Rift, the classic African savanna and dry woodland forest, the one that you think of when you think of Africa, where there's a large lake there, which dries out mostly during the dry season and becomes one of the great plains areas that big game multiplies or at least gathers on. It has, and this is really remarkable, on the west side of the park, close to the Zimbabwe border, the Gorongosa mountain range, and particularly with the peak of over 6,000 feet. On the top of that range, which is, has been regarded probably for millennia as sacred by the surrounding population, is a rainforest, similar to the Great Congo rainforest, which withdrew from this area tens of millions of years ago. So we have an isolated and previously unexplored, that is biologically unexplored, rainforest on the top. And then in another corner of the park are a series of gorges, which have along their bottoms along the streams at the bottoms, rainforest also, a different form of rainforest with different creatures in it. All of this has remained up until the renovation began, generally unexplored, scientifically unexplored. So believe me, that was a real magnet. I could go back, not just just go to a national forest like this in Africa and study, but also I could go back to the 19th century and be an explorer naturalist, one of the first people with a scientific background to go in and see these places.
You know, the area you briefly mentioned was badly damaged during a civil war. The area had at one time major big game, but now you can still find big game there. Would you tell us a little bit about what happened as a result of this civil war and what kind of animals are coming back?
What happened during the Civil War was that the whole country, or most of the country, mercifully to the exclusion of the several major cities, was invaded actually by a mercenary army, the RENAMO, which was financed by the white colonial government at that time, and the Rhodesian white colonial government in an effort to suppress and prevent the newly freed people of Mozambique from adopting a communist government. It was beginning to turn for aid to the Soviet Union and China. And as a result, a really bloody civil war swept the land. An estimated 1 million people died. Another 3 million went into essentially exile. We didn't hear much about this terrible destruction in the United States. I guess our mind was elsewhere. Nonetheless, it did acquire a democracy, and it has been fortunately in favor of parks and ecotourism that connected with parks and is encouraging of even expanding the parks. So it was possible to bring big game animal species back in a few cases where they'd been just about totally eliminated and then leave the others alone so that it could multiply. But let me add at once the fortunate circumstance that while the RENAMO, the mercenary invaders were able to occupy the Gorongosa area and eliminate a lot of the big game just by poaching, there was not a major effect, as far as I can see, on the vegetation or on the insect fauna, which is where I've concentrated my research efforts.
You describe your experience there as filling you with delight. You said the plant life is exuberant. Did you feel a real sense of joy? What's the experience of being in this place?
Well, it's double. First of all, it was just a wonderful opportunity to do one of the first biological biodiversity studies in the area. And since that time, Peter Naskrecki, who's currently science director of a new center there, has been expanding this greatly. To be the first in an unexplored area. I don't mean physically unexplored, but where the fauna, especially of the little creatures, insects, spiders, and so on, the little things that run the earth, I like to call them. But in addition, there's Africa. I know a lot of people, from long-term residents to casual novelists and explorers passing through as a visit, have described something about the African savanna and dry woodlands that begins to make you quickly feel at home. You find it attractive. And we know now increasingly why people think the African savanna is attractive. And perhaps we can bring that up we close this program.
I'm Jessica Yellen. This is On Point. I'm in for Tom Ashbrook. I'm talking with naturalist and biologist E.O. Wilson about his new book, A Window on Eternity, and his thoughts on how the human race can find its proper place on Earth. Professor Wilson, one of the points you make in the book is that as humans, we are destroying our environment and some of the species in it. What's the data? How destructive are we, if you can measure it?
Well, we're terribly destructive, and we're not paying attention to the database that does exist on how fast the destruction is proceeding. I say we. I mean most of humanity, of course, and even a lot of the leaders in environmental science and the environmental movement. The world is growing green. It's pastel green, of course, and that's a good thing. But you may have noticed that most of the concern is focused on the non-living world, you know, like climate change, using up of natural resources, pollution. And it's proper that we should pay a lot of attention to that because it's harmful to human being. But it's shifted away from the non-living world. And this is not a good thing because we should realize that we are ourselves are a biological species in a biological world, and that we need the rest of the living world. We do not have precise figures on the rapidity with which we're destroying the natural world, but we can be fairly sure that we've jacked up the extinction rate of species all around the world with human activity unintentionally increased it to as much as 1,000 times what it was baseline. And we're on our way toward 10,000 times above baseline. And what was that baseline? From paleontology, we can say roughly it was that one species was going extinct per million species per year, one per million per year. So we're now moving that orders of magnitude higher, and we're witnessing whole sections of species becoming extinct. One of the most dramatic, for example, was during the first colonization of Polynesia, in which about 1,000 bird species went extinct, 10% of all the birds in the world. We haven't had that much catastrophe yet in most places, but it's approaching that. And we should be paying attention to this world that took, how shall I put it, 3.5 billion years to evolve into a pretty well integrated and productive system in which we were ourselves born, to which we are exquisitely well developed, and on which we depend. We should be thinking about this more seriously on every second we live. If we destroy it, this at the rate we are, we'll have lost half of the species. Many of us who study these trends agree. Half of species on Earth by the end of the century with unforeseeable circumstances. And remember, that extinction sucks. Extinction. I read that on a T-shirt recently. I love it. And that extinction is really irreversible. So any decision we make, and such decisions are being made every day, unfortunately, to let species slide away into extinction is not reversible.
Professor Wilson, let's go to a caller. Mark is calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Mark. You're on.
Hi, Jessica. Hi. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for calling. What's your comment?
I applaud the professor's work. I was in Mozambique in 1990, moving through the Pira Corridor, and saw extinction of people. So, yes, extinction does suck. I agree wholeheartedly. I need to find that T-shirt. But I applaud his efforts, because when I came back from Mozambique, people asked me what it was like, and my comment was that it was apocalyptic, in a sense, so much destruction. So I applaud the professor's work, and that humility, yes, is absolutely, humility is a power, and it's essential for reversing the devastation the professor is discussing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Professor Wilson, let's go to another call. Addison is calling from Fairfax, Vermont. Hi, Addison.
Hi, Jessica. Hi, E.O. Wilson. So I guess my comment is, first of all, I've read a number of your books. I applaud your work. You're very inspirational to me. And my question is, if the same rules of nature apply to us as other species, in that there are carrying capacities for each species, and in many ways we've reached or exceeded our carrying capacity on this planet, do you think that as a human species we can rebound, or do you think extinction is inevitable because of the impact we've had on our environment? Thank you.
Thank you,
well,
Addison.
Yes, thank you, Allison. Extinction is not inevitable for the human species, but let's say a radical change in bad ways is quite possible, I think is inevitable. That is to say, as we strip off the natural environment and those, there's an estimated 8 million other species, a community to which we belong, we're stripping away what we do not know what we are stripping away. We're stripping away, at the very least, a large part of the productivity of the world. And the very atmosphere we breathe, we're stripping away, in many parts of the world, the storage areas, the production areas of rain and fresh water and their storage areas in higher elevations, and on and on and on. And we don't know, since each species can be regarded as a kind of epic of evolution, which study is produces large amounts of new scientific information. Each species is valuable that way. We don't know what we're tossing away in terms of the library of scientific information on which our species really is going to depend in centuries to come.
Professor Wilson, how can we know then that this isn't just part of our natural process, that we're intended to destroy part of our environment, and that is in itself part of evolution?
Intended by whom?
Well, this is a good question, but that's
that's the answer. We're in total control. We haven't got any particular destiny. The Earth doesn't have any particular destiny, but we are the first species to have achieved this much impact as a single species on the rest of the world, especially on the 8 million or whatever the exact number is, other species on the planet.
Do you talk about the era of man. Would you describe a little bit what that is and why you want it to end?
Yeah, well, this is a subject I'm writing on right now. The term that's getting currency and more discussion is the Anthropocene. That means, literally, the age of man And it's been proposed half seriously at first, but now increasingly with increasing seriousness as an epoch of geological rank. That would be the equivalent of the Pleistocene, the Holocene, before the Pleistocene, Pliocene, Miocene, so on, because the amount of damage, change that humanity has created in a relatively short time, particularly since the Industrial Revolution, has already changed the soil, atmosphere, and species constitution as a fauna and flora around the world in so many places as to give some validity to making a new geologic era. But and that would be, I think, a worthwhile observation. It's a good talking point. However, there is an ideology of Anthropocene, which is gaining currency as well. And it is that we should just assume that this is the way, this is the destiny of the world, that it be taken over by one species, that eventually, maybe sooner than we thought, the whole world will become humanized, and a lot of species will go extinct. Of course, that's too bad. But we are going to be a planet ruled and run pole to pole. We should therefore stop worrying about saving a whole bunch of species everywhere. There is no longer any wilderness, this ideology argues. They should come to Gorongosa, of course, and go on into the Congo, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, this is a view which I like to put it is by a group of people, none of whom I'm aware of has done research in biodiversity, none of whom has displayed knowledge of biodiversity that would serve them well as a beginning graduate student in ecology. And I cannot remain silent about this particular new approach. And that's why I'm writing a book to say, let us have an end to this particular viewpoint. What is being proposed is retreat with the first whiff of grape shot.
Hmm. Wow. Let's go to the phones. Joe is calling from Charles City, Virginia. Joe, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for calling.
Very interesting conversation. I'm just curious, though, again, how at the end the professor's last remarks, again, indicate these are observations and edicts and mandates from on high that us, the common folk, couldn't possibly grasp. Therefore, any opinion other than those that agree with him are bogus. I was wondering if you'd comment on that. Thank you very much.
Are you referring to the folks in the Anthropocene or to me personally?
Okay, he's not there. I think what he's saying is that a lot of people who disagree and don't want to invest as much or think we're in such a state of crisis about the environment feel like they're dismissed as uneducated and their question or their point isn't worth validating because they couldn't possibly understand if they don't share, for example, your view. Is it necessarily ignorant to not share your view?
Well, that's not true of people working on biodiversity. We were rather late coming into the whole environmental arena to point out certain facts that need to be paid attention to. And that's probably in the same category as climate change. We will, I think, respond to the trends that are quantitatively verifiable about the loss of species if we just go along without paying any attention from scientists who are not arrogant that way. They're just saying this is what we are finding out. Then we will end up with a world, and finally people will, I think, accept what the data show. When there's not much left of the natural world, just as when folks in New York City are waiting to work.
Can you explain this? I think this gets to the concept. You write in the book, you're describing spiders and butterflies, and you say predators and prey populations pull against one another and bring their populations back to the original status quo. Can you explain what that small example says about how we have to live in concert with the organisms around us?
Well, I think everyone knows that humanity is still expanding exponentially, and that we are now 7 billion people, and that population growth is possibly just beginning to slow down. What they don't realize, most people, is that we are scheduled, for reasons we can go into here if it's needed, to peak at around 10 billion by the end of the century, at which point populations will then begin to recede. I see this century as very much a bottleneck of continuing population growth, but with open-ended at the end. I mean, that is, with a good result at the end, but maybe too late. 10 billion people is way more than what I think the planet can comfortably maintain. In fact, by 2050, it's estimated, we'll be at something like 8 or 9 billion, and we require twice the amount of food that we're producing in the world right now. And this is the kind of situation I don't think we really are going to be comfortable with. So I think we should. What's the solution? The solution is to devote a great deal more scientific and technological research on creating new food sources, on shrinking — this is where the conservation part comes in — shrinking the ecological footprint. That is, making smaller the amount of space on the planet each person needs, from food to water to education to transportation and so on, in order to live a life of quality. And those should be our great goals, I think, for the coming decades.
I'm impressed to hear that you say we can find new food sources through technology. So it's not all nature that we're basing this on.
Science and technology have brought us where we are today. And science and technology are going to have to take us out of the cul-de-sac that we've entered.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. I'm talking with world-famous naturalist E.O. Wilson about his ideas on how human beings can survive on this planet and avoid the lonely fate that awaits us if the so-called age of man continues as it has. Professor Wilson, let's go to another call. Kevin is calling in from Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Jessica. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, Professor. I got to tell you, as a retired biologist, I'm almost hopeless, because our politicians refuse to believe any science. Every time there's a scientific discovery made, they come up with some reason why it's a lie. And they're obviously just influenced by big business, and they really don't have our interests or the interests of our beautiful Earth in their hearts or in their minds. That's all I want to say. Thank you for taking my call.
Kevin, thank you for calling. Professor Wilson, there's a lot to be glum about, but can you give us cause for hope? Do you see steps?
I like to quote Abba Eban. He was a foreign minister in the 1967 war with Israel and its Arab neighbors. And in the midst of all this madness, when it seemed like the Middle East would sink into oblivion or into a total chaos. I admit that that never completely has gone away. But at any rate, Abba Eban said of this that when all else fails, men turn to reason. Hmm. And I think that that's what's going to happen. You know, when the seas rise, when the hurricanes double in intensity, When the temperatures continue to rise globally, those are all trends that are happening. And then finally, when we see enough of the great wild areas of the world, whether they're Borneo or Madagascar or parts of Africa, if we see them obliterated, I think people will turn to reason. I realize that's not a very optimistic forecast, but I think eventually we will turn. What I like to feel is that we're going to turn and actually get serious about the state of the planet before we do too much damage.
There is a new report coming out tomorrow at the White House saying that climate change is here and it's impacting the planet now. So it's time to take concrete steps. And some of our callers and Facebookers are writing in with their questions about what they can do specifically. One question we have from Coast Ghost is, how much does ecotourism contribute to the environmental degradation, like flying to another side of the globe to marvel firsthand at some pristine natural environment? This person says seems hardly responsible given what we're told about the impairment of the upper atmosphere by jet exhaust. So are you concerned about ecotourism?
Oh, I love ecotourism. For one thing, Mozambique is one of the poorest countries in the world. It has per diem average income of only a dollar, and it needs all the money it can get. And this is one reason that, fortunately, the Mozambican leadership is very sympathetic toward Gorongosa, the restoration, and to the addition of other national parks. But we have to do far more than that. I think we have to engage people in ways that they find productive to their own quality of life, and that's often through ecotourism. And I would hope, too, that part of that would be to expand the definition of wildlife to include creatures other than just the big mammals. We have a new center now at Gorongosa Park, which is for science and education, both of visitors and of the surrounding people to be participants. And this includes the first such study outside of a couple of American parks, including the Great Smokies Mountain National Park, which is doing it, of exploring thoroughly the biodiversity of the entire park, not just the big animals, but also all of the plants, all the species of the plants, and all the species of the insects and spiders. And we already have wonderful examples of natural history to show even the least exposed tourists to previous natural history. Wonderful things to see.
Professor Wilson, Matt is on the phone. He's calling from West Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, Jessica. How are you?
I'm well.
I just wanted to say that, you know, in my short life, the entire population of the human species has more than doubled. And by the time I'm your age, Professor, God knows where we'll be. And I feel like there's a growing instinctual alarm bell going on, just a knowledge that we are out of sync with the planet and that we need to redress the balance in some way. That being said, though, talking about biodiversity, and I feel like as long as there's inequality in issues which have less to do with the natural world and more to do with, you know, half the planet not having enough to eat or clean water, or at the end of the day, even just the global economy, it's all driven by this sense of imbalance and you take. Do you feel like we have to solve those issues before we can focus the efforts of the whole world on trying to fix the natural order and the state of things?
I think they go together very intimately, and we should do them simultaneously. I believe we should, it's not going to be easy, but we really need to give more space to the natural world and all those other millions of species at the same time that we're improving the quality of life of every person on the planet. That's why I put so much emphasis on science and technology focused on just these issues in order to create some advance in their simultaneity of purpose. Nature and humanity have to coexist.
And on that note, you're also teaching locals in Gorongosa to live in concert with the park. That strikes me as a new approach to preservation involving the people who live there. Is that something new?
I can only give Greg Carr more credit on this. What he's doing is to try to improve education. Mostly the surrounding people do not read or write, and a great many of them can't even speak the national language of Portuguese. Moving them up as quickly as possible. My guide of 3 years ago, during my first visit, for example, now it has been the first person of his immediate community to make it through high school, and he's now at the university in Tanzania, being trained to be he wants to be a naturalist and wildlife specialist. So that's a key to very much the same to bring things upward. In addition, Greg Carr has had a policy, which I don't know whether he can do it completely, but he's succeeded in a number of cases of when a poacher is captured, and usually these are younger men who are poor, very poor, with nothing else, and no other way to make any kind of a living, he makes them rangers. Hmm. And the poacher to ranger one-step process actually has worked. It's produced some really splendid advocates of natural history among the local people.
Greg Carr, just to remind the audience, is the philanthropist who is funding this preservation of Gorongosa National Park. And one of the points you make in the video that accompanies your book is that if you're able to bring the park back to its natural state, it can lead to more tourism, which in turn can help the local population. So it's a reminder that saving our environment can also save us.
Yes, that's just one of many ways. I think when we start studying the world's biodiversity, we save it first, then we start studying it species by species. And we reckon that probably as one-third of the species on Earth have only one-third or less have been discovered, much less studied. The vast majority have never been studied, known and unknown, that once we get to the science of studying these species we're saving, we're going to find all kinds of new applications that help humanity in more ways than I think we have even begun to imagine.
And there's a lot of mystery in the book as well. I was listening to your tour guide say that, or one of the local folklores is that Noah's Ark landed in Gorongosa Park. And you've said that it's reasonable to believe that this area was the birthplace for the human race. Is that correct?
I think that's just the conclusion drawn by generations of archaeologists, students of human evolution, and so on. Gorongosa and the lower reaches of the drift, but other parts of Africa too, particularly Eastern Africa, are the places, the domain in which the human species evolved.
But no evidence that something like a Noah's Ark may have landed there, that myth arose from some historical fact?
Oh, that's part of the local origin myth.
Hmm. Okay.
Of course, you would expect folks to believe the way we do, namely that humanity was once created at Gorongosa, and particularly on the mountain, and that God lived there and so on. But that's the belief. But there's, of course not. That's not likely to be – that particular creation story is not likely to be true.
Let's go to Nino, who's calling from Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Nino.
Hello, Jessica.
Hi.
Professor Wilson, very briefly, I'd like your thoughts on, as someone who meditates on this very often, How would you, among your friends and peers, elevate the conversation and initiate those around you that you care about into a deeper understanding of the language of consilience in our own animal language without coming across as evangelical or radical? It's a discursive problem that I run up against a lot.
Well, it's a very good formulation you just made of one of the central problems. I believe that we're coming around now at this stage of agreeing as a nation that we've got to improve our education. We're in just scores registered by our students. We find America way down under a large number of countries that are surprising to find have moved above us in quality of our education. So we need particularly to improve science and technology education. I think most Americans would agree with that heartily. I may be sadly mistaken on that, but I think that's coming around, that we have to be more competitive if we're going to keep the middle class strong. And one way of doing this is of introducing science and technology more effectively into our educational system is by study of the environment and by studies specifically of biodiversity. I've spoken with teachers in high schools and liberal arts colleges especially all over the country who've had great success when they take students into the field on research projects, and particularly when they explore what's in a particular habitat or what particular species are doing and the like, and make that a research project that they can participate in. And this works for 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds. It also works for advanced students in high school or entering students in college.
You're talking about taking practical steps. Let's discuss one. You advocate the creation of wildland corridors. What is a wildland corridor?
I'm working very much on that right now. In fact, I'm about to go back to the Florida Panhandle shortly to join another dedicated world citizen, I like to call him, Mr. M.C. Davis, who has started the move to create a string of reserves that run from Tallahassee to Texas. It can be done, in which you have continuous movement of faunas and floras, which would, I think, take a lot of the pressure off of climate change, in which you have a drying trend moving eastward. The state of Florida already has such a corridor, at least partly constructed, that'll range from from the Everglades to the Okefenokee, and it's a growing movement that we should have more wild areas, create them if possible by changing protected areas and then adding to them to make corridors that could run all the way around North America and on down into the tropics. And this would be not only a great advance in straightforward conservation, but it also would meet some of the challenge presented us by climate change.
Professor, in the minute and a half we have left, big question. Do you think humans have an innate drive to conquer and control, or do you think there's something primal in us that yearns for untouched nature so we'll ultimately protect it?
You know, it's a very good question, and I think we have both. This is one of those cases of the better and the worst angels of human nature. We've always succeeded, particularly when there were lots of resources out there to conquer, in expanding our population, improving our quality of life, actually, and our technologies by conquest. But now we've run out of land, and we are at the maximum that the globe can probably sustain. And therefore, we should call on our better angels that I believe are innate in the human nature.
Well, if I may say so, Professor Wilson, you are one of our better angels. Thank you so much for your work, for joining us today, and for your new book, A Window on Eternity. And you all can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And coming up tomorrow on Point, using bitcoins to buy drugs, guns, you name it. We'll look at Dark Wallet. It's the new software that will protect your identity. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.